From the University of Virginia's Karsh Institute, this is Democracy in Danger. I'm Robert Armengol, the show's producer. This week, we're bringing you another installment of our special series, The Power of Many. Fueled by UVA's Democratic Futures Project, The Power of Many connects you with advocates and activists from all over the world who are fighting authoritarianism and laying the groundwork for the rule of the people and the rule of the law across cultures. We owe a lot to UVA English professor Steve Parks for his tireless efforts to support that work. Recently, Steve caught up with one of the pro-democracy advocates in his global network, Nicaraguan exile Felix Maradiaga. And in a moment, we're going to play you that interview. First, here's some background on Maradiaga's story and the long struggle for peace and justice in Nicaragua.
This was the scene in Nicaragua 4 months ago. On one side, the Nicaraguan army, defending the government in power and powerfully armed with mostly American weapons.
For much of the 20th century, after a 24-year U.S. occupation that ended in 1933, Nicaragua was ruled by the corrupt and brutal Somoza family dynasty.
Last month, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights accused Somoza's government of flagrant abuses of human rights, including arbitrary detention, summary executions, and torture. The victims.
After a terrible earthquake in 1972, a socialist insurrection against the regime gained ground and ultimately came to power under Daniel Ortega.
On the other side, the muchachos, youngsters with pistols, rifles, and machetes, and supported in spirit by what they claim is a majority of Nicaraguans.
The so-called Sandinistas carried out their own abuses during this time, including torture, disappearances, and the suppression of opposition parties. All this seesawing seemed to abate in 1990 when the Sandinistas lost a national election by 14 percentage points. And what followed were 16 years of fairly stable center-right rule. But again, in 2006, Ortega was elected to the presidency, where he's been ever since.
In 1978, I was in charge of a guerrilla unit in the insurrection in northern Nicaragua. I cannot say how many men I killed, but yes, I was in a situation where you had to kill or be killed.
Once a romantic figure who stood up to U.S. puppets, Ortega has all but taken control of the media and government institutions.
In 2018, Nicaraguans revolted. Thousands took to the streets to protest Ortega's proposed cuts to Social Security for senior citizens. Soon, protesters were calling for Ortega and his wife to step down.
Hundreds of protesters have been imprisoned, many killed, some by snipers on rooftops.
That demonstration was confronted with brutal force.
And a lot of dissidents like Felix Maradiaga have been forced to leave the country. Let's turn now to Steve's conversation with Felix, who founded the Civil Society Leadership Institute in 2007 to educate pro-democracy advocates. And Felix is on a crusade to end the practice of arbitrary detention in his own country and elsewhere. Here's Steve with Felix.
So many times when I talk with advocates, it turns out their parents or someone in their family history has already sort of been publicly protesting for democracy or having an active public role in politics. And this is the case with you, right? Your father, when he was a student, was engaged in public protest, right?
Well, actually, the story of Nicaragua, it's very painful because we come from a divided society. So my father was indeed part of that generation that suffered another dictatorship. He was never involved in a political party. He was simply a student. that at the time thought that the system was very unfair, but he was actually arbitrarily detained for studying abroad at the University of Chile at a time where Chile was going through the Allende administration. And upon returning to Nicaragua, most students that had been in Chile were suspected to be progressive by the military dictatorship of the time. So he was arbitrarily detained. And the fact that he suffered so much and what he endured as a survivor of torture was definitely something that marked my childhood. On the other hand, my mother, quite conservative, never involved in politics. She was a high school teacher and also run a small grocery store. My mother suffered expropriation, the loss of her property because of the Marxist Sandinista dictatorship. So growing up as one parent persecuted by a far-right military dictatorship and a mother persecuted by a leftist Marxist regime, in a way developed a sense of admiration for tolerance and democracy. I don't think there are such things as good autocracies. I think that at the end of the day, individual freedoms can be fully affected and individual lives and human dignity can be deeply affected by political extremism.
When you were very young, I know your mother made that very difficult decision to send you to the United States. And by then, I think she had lost her grocery store. There was an attempt to recruit child soldiers. Like, what were the context and situation that led her to send you on your own to the United States?
You know, it took me many years to understand that decision. It's something that I've came to terms as an adult. But as a kid, it's very hard to understand. I mean, we were living a war. My first memories as a kid were actually surviving the bombings during this 1979 revolt. But then by 1985, my father had passed away. My mother was left with no protection as a single mother, as a widow. And her assets, properties, bank accounts, everything was seized by the regime. It was very clear that even though she was not political at all, she had profound disagreements with the Sandinistas. But I think there was something else that really marked the time. It was the fact that I had two very close cousins. They were almost like brothers to me, about the same age themselves. They were 5 years older than me. And one of them was recruited. His name is Edman. He was recruited by the Contras. And the other one was recruited by the Sandinistas. And I think that as a family, seeing these two wonderful kids as child soldiers on two different factions, in a way scared our family and brought the cruelty of civil war into our house. And my mother took the very difficult decision of sending me abroad. She applied for visas to many different countries and we couldn't find a visa. So I had to come as an undocumented person from Nicaragua all the way to the United States. I presented voluntarily myself up on the border to the authorities. I had with me, you know, documentation of the political persecution of my family. So I was immediately granted a parole upon entrance at the point of entry in the United States. It's a decision that I think created so much pain, not only at that time, but up until today. It's a very, very tough topic. My mother, she's a wonderful human being. Her name is Carmen. When I speak about this publicly, she's clearly uncomfortable. But it's just opened a complete new understanding of how the mothers of children who grew up in conflict zones have to take extreme decisions to save the lives of their kids. And that's what my mother did.
And what was that journey like for you? And at that age, did you have a sense of what the United States was? I mean, the United States will play a big role later in your life. But at that moment, as you were taking that journey, the right had persecuted your family, the left had persecuted your family. How did you understand the United States?
It was very interesting because, as I said, I come from my mother that it's, you know, very conservative. She went to a nun school. My father was you know, quite progressive and believed in social justice and so on. So I grew up in a family that had significant political disagreements amongst my parents, but a lot of love, a lot of compassion, a very deeply faithful family. So education was very important, even though we lived in a very small town. My parents always worried, even at an early age, that I would have, you know, exposure to books and so on. And this is an interesting story, because at the time, the only available literature was literature, you know, from Cuba or from the Soviet Union. And I had that kind of political education that every single child in Nicaragua, I would call it propaganda, was absorbing. My mother made it like a case to do like homeschooling on democracy. And it meant a perspective of the U.S. because when she was at a private Catholic school in Nicaragua, she did trips to the U.S. as a young student. And it was an eye-opening experience for her. My grandmother on my father's side, she's still alive. She's 106 years old. She's an American citizen. So I had the other version of deep admiration to the United States democracy. So I think that that gave me an interesting perspective. So in a nutshell, the U.S. was a land of opportunities, but at the same time, I always knew, and I continue to feel that way, that as impressive that this country is in many, many ways, it has, of course, many other things that some people do not like, but my true home is Nicaragua. The U.S., it's a temporary safe haven, and that's the same way I saw it as a kid.
And you decided very early on, I think you were like 19 or 20, to start working on behalf of Nicaragua. Like, what were some of the first public acts you did to support Nicaraguan communities or the Nicaraguan nation as a whole?
So I came at age 12 to the U.S., came back to Nicaragua when democracy was reestablished in 1990. And upon returning to Nicaragua from exile, I was still a teenager, but the local Catholic Church took me under their wing, and they asked me to be the youth leader of a youth group in my hometown. And we used to plant trees. We used to go to the hospitals and you know, and help people. But there was one specific activity that was life-changing. Back in 1992, a church of my community organized a trip to an area deep in the Nicaraguan jungles, in the forest. And I went to that community in an area called Rancho Grande. It's very hard to get there even today. And I saw a lot of victims from anti-personal landmines. And can you imagine someone at age 15 looking at kids their age who've lost their lower limbs, you know, their legs, because of a landmine? So it was my first immediate exposure to the atrocities of civil war. It was at that time that I felt the comfort that my words from a spiritual perspective could deliver. So at that time, I didn't understand what was going on in my identity. I thought I was going to be a Catholic priest using my words of comfort for those people who had, you know, suffered. And it connected with my own suffering as someone who has lost his father at age 8, who had gone through the unaccompanied minor experience, who had lived with foster parents for 2 years in the U.S., who had spent time at a refugee center in the border. So the suffering of those local communities, in a way, were a mirror of my own suffering. I didn't understand what was happening. It was later until I went to college and started to understand conflict from a more academic perspective that it was clear to me that nonviolence was not only an academic interest, but a mission, a passion. And it's what I do until today.
One of the first things you did is you worked for the Office of Disarmament and Reintegration, where you went out into the mountains and tried to get former soldiers to come back and give up weapons, right? Like, what was that work like?
It was a clear example of how the dots are connected in our life without making much sense at the time. So the experience in 1992 with those communities was not only life-changing, but it became a practice to me. So I came back to those communities over and over again with my church. In fact, I stayed with those families at times for several months. So fast forward to 1997, I was a senior in college, and a new government came into power, and they created this office that would do very practical public service to victims of war and the reinsertion of former combatants, what we call today DDR. And the government called the church in this area of Nicaragua called Matagalpa to ask for recommendations for someone that could understand those communities, that could be a civilian that would understand reinsertion of victims of war and former combatants. And despite the fact that I was only 20 years old at the time, I received a recommendation, and then I was invited to come initially as an intern. I thought I was going to be there only for a few months. I ended up staying almost 10 years. So I accepted the work at that office, which was really complicated, meaningful, even very dangerous work. It meant that I had to work with those communities, but not anymore from a spiritual or faith perspective, but as a civil servant who will go to the communities and map from a very practical public policy point of view, the needs of those communities, what former combatants needed so they can be reinserted into social and economic life. Do they need how to learn how to read and write? Do they need investments so they could have a local school, technical assistance for their small farms, prostheses for those who have lost their limbs during the war, and so on. So it was a fascinating work that later opened a whole career, because I did the same thing later on for United Nations.
Yeah, if I hear your story, I hear a consistent desire for like this better Nicaragua. And then Ortega gets reelected. How do you understand why that happened? And what has been the effect on Nicaragua?
Well, Nicaragua had this transition towards democracy between 1990 and 2006. And this is clearly a case study of how democracy can go into a deficit and into a reversion if democracies cannot deliver results. And that's what, quite frankly, happened to Nicaragua. And I'd say this, even though I was part of those governments that worked a lot on post-conflict reconstruction, on rebuilding Nicaragua from the war, reconnecting Nicaragua to international capital markets, taking care of the foreign debt. Nicaragua, economically speaking, was a disaster after the Sandinistas. But I think that many of these democratic political parties lost touch with the daily lives of many Nicaraguans. And Ortega was able to fool some Nicaraguans, and he was reelected in 2007. It was very painful for me because it was as a direct victim of the Sandinistas in the 80s, I always knew that it was going to go into a disaster. It's a lesson for democracies all around the world. We cannot take democracy for granted. And I think that that's what happened to many Nicaraguans. Now, we are in a situation in which Nicaragua, according to the 2024 report, Freedom of the World, that has been produced for over four decades for Freedom House, has identified Nicaragua as the country in the world that experienced the greatest decline in freedoms compared to previous years.
One of the things we're learning is that dictators learn from each other. And increasingly, arbitrary detention is a tool that's being used to stomp out democratic movements, stomp out free speech. How has arbitrary detention been used in Nicaragua, and how has it led to your campaign right now around arbitrary detention?
Yes, so a little bit of background. Arbitrary detention has always been a problem in Nicaragua, particularly under Ortega. But things got really complicated in 2018 when there were massive protests against the regime, and the regime brutally suppressed dissent, resulting in the deaths of 350 protesters in that year alone. But it also led to widespread imprisonment. Between 2018 and 2024, the regime has imprisoned over 2,200 Nicaraguans, of which 130 people continue to be in arbitrary detention. But this is not only a case of Nicaragua. Nicaragua might be one of the extreme cases in the world, but we are seeing this, of course, in China, Venezuela, Cuba. We're seeing this in Uzbekistan. We're seeing this in Zimbabwe. We're seeing this in many parts of the world. And I tend to share this analogy with my experience working with victims of anti-personnel landmines. These weapons, landmines, create immense physical, emotional suffering because of the mutilation, but they don't typically kill the person. And when I asked military experts, why was that? The response is that landmines were designed to demoralize, because when you demoralize a combatant, you create a bigger problem for troops than casualties, right? And I think that's extremely inhumane and perverse. That's sick, right? Trying to mutilate someone so the resources invested in taking care of that wounded person are higher that dealing with a soldier who was missed in combat. Well, arbitrary detention for political reasons is that type of political weapon, because when a political leader gets arrested, then the entire resources of the family of the dissident are devoted to try to get that person out of prison. The political movement has to stop talking about public policies, has to stop paying enough attention to political reforms to actually focus on political prisoners. And regimes around the world, Nicaragua is only one of them, who are part of that club of dictators, have understood this kind of inhumane political weapon. And I don't think the international community really gets the point that these dictatorships have evolved. They're highly sophisticated. They understand how democracies work. And what they've done is something that I've labeled, I'm sure someone else used that term before, dictatorships 2.0, which are dictatorships that use a facade of institutionalism to create this kind of suffering. So for example, they will persecute a dissident, but they will charge that dissident with a number of felonies or crimes. And they will use arbitrary detention for a number of other reasons to make it look as legitimate persecution, not for political reasons. And that's what we're trying to tackle.
So before Felix signed off, Steve asked him about his own time in detention, nearly 2 years beginning in 2021, and how that experience shaped his career. Here's what he had to say.
So the regime in July 2018 charged me with terrorism and treason, arguing that these trainings were part of a coup d'etat. So I had to face those charges. And eventually in 2021, when I launched my political campaign as presidential candidate, the other candidates and myself were actually going into a primary process within our umbrella political movement were all arrested. I spent 611 days in extreme inhumane conditions, but thanks to the relentless advocacy of people like my wife, Berta Valle, I was released in February of last year. But I didn't achieve a full freedom. 222 political prisoners, including myself, were deported from Nicaragua. The United States welcomed us. In fact, the U.S. government sent a plane to pick these 222 political prisoners. And upon landing in Washington, D.C., we learned that we had been declared stateless, that the Constitution had been reformed to make it impossible for us to go back, and all our assets had been shut down. So today, I work reorganizing the democratic opposition in exile, and I also provide technical advice to human rights defenders around the world, mostly through the World Liberty Congress and through my own foundation. And one of the main aims of my work is to support families of political prisoners and hopefully to try to bring international legal reform that will bring greater protections to human rights defenders and dissidents against arbitrary detention.
One last question. What was your day-to-day life like during those 660-some days?
It's very hard to verbalize. I mean, the first thought that comes to your mind when you walked into those prisons that I only can define as medieval is why in the 21st century there are places in the world that have those prisons. So they're nothing of what we're used to see in movies or documentaries. But in our case, complete isolation with no reading materials, nothing to write, not even a Bible. The water that we had to drink every day had to be delivered on a daily basis by a family member that had to wait for 3 hours outside the prison to deliver a couple of bottles of water. We never had access to any recreation, never had access to a lawyer. The trial took place inside the prison in complete isolation without any access to the public. I never had any access to a lawyer. So these mechanisms are designed to destroy you and to kill you. And in fact, some of the prisoners actually died in prison because of those conditions. Also, very bad food, deprivation of light, non-ending interrogations for hours and hours for months, even after I was already sentenced to 13 years in prison. I continued to be interrogated. I was always in chains while I was being interrogated, which has created permanent damage to my back muscles because of the position that I endured at times for as long as 10 hours of interrogation. So I've been out of prison since February of last year, and I continue to have hard times to speak about this publicly. These systems are designed to break your soul, and I think also are designed to make you hate and to create resentment. When you think about this, you'll see a pattern of dictatorships. You know, they know that by breaking your soul, it's also breaking your faith in human dignity, in the human species. And I refuse to be broken. And I refuse to lose my compassion, my faith, my spirituality. And I refuse to think that human beings are so perverse. I think that peace and reconciliation continues to be possible. And I have started by making an audit to my heart and making sure that the work I continue to do is not out of vengeance, it's not out of revenge, it's not out of resentment, it's out of a deep commitment to the idea of freedom and democracy.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Félix Maradiaga is a political activist and a founding director of the Civil Society Leadership Institute. From 2002 to 2006, he was Secretary General of Defense under Nicaraguan President Enrique Bolaños. Earlier, he directed the Office for the Reintegration of Ex-Combatants. In 2015, Forbes named him one of the 25 most influential people in Central America. That's going to do it for this week on Democracy in Danger. Next time, we'll hear about a different kind of arbitrary detention, right here in the U.S. of A.
At the very beginning, when the anti-Japanese hysteria was starting, usually the government rounded up the adult males first.
Stay in touch in the meantime. You can follow us on Instagram at DNDpodcast or leave a comment on our webpage, dindanger.org. You'll find show notes and links to what we're reading, really a virtual syllabus for every episode. Democracy in Danger is produced by me, Robert Armengol, with help from Nicholas Scott, Stephen Betts, and Ariana Aronson. Adin Yeager engineers the show. Our interns are Charlie Burns, Lena Freyhat, Katie Pyle, Makhdoum Morad Shah, and Caroline Yu. We have help from Ellie Salvatierra. And special thanks, of course, this time to Steve Parks and the Democratic Futures Project. Support for Democracy in Danger comes from the University of Virginia's College of Arts and Sciences. The show is a project of UVA's Karsh Institute of Democracy. We're distributed by the Virginia Audio Collective of WTJU Radio in Charlottesville. Siva Vaidyanathan and Will Hitchcock will be back with you next week. Stay with us.